Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Chedem and Aleph by the two dots. Here we're describing where the sota was brought. It was brought to the Shar Nicanor, Shesham Mashkim et HaSotot. That was a place where they gave the sotot to drink. And the Mishnah mentioned two other individuals who end up at Shar Nicanor. One was for the Tarata Mitzora, and the other one was for the Yoledet, when she brings her Korbanot. So Gemara says, Bishlama Sotot. For sotot, it makes sense, tichtive mida kohen et isha lifnei Hashem, that the kohen brings the woman before Hashem. So in order to be lifnei Hashem, she has to be proximate to the area that is considered to be lifnei Hashem. Rashi says something very interesting over here. It says, v'hu petach shebo derech nisa v'itziah l'chol baye azara. This was the main avenue of access and egress from the azara. Therefore, it's deemed to be the place that's called Lifnei Hashem. So you have multiple sharim to enter in, but since this is the main thoroughfare, or the main way to go in, that's considered to be Lifnei Hashem. That's interesting. Others suggest that it's Mizrach on the eastern side, because in the Mishkan, there was only one entrance to the Azara, or the area that would be similar to what the Azara is. That was on the eastern side, so Shar Nicanor would be the equivalent to that. The simplest explanation is brought by the Rambam, which is Lifnei Hashem, this is the only Sha'ar that faces the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKodeshim, meaning that the doorways on the eastern side were mekuvanot, were lined up with the entrance to the Heichal and the entrance to the Kodesh HaKodeshim. If you want to be Lifnei Hashem, that would be the gateway that looks directly towards Lifnei Hashem. Again, we discussed yesterday why she doesn't go in further necessarily, because that would be even more Lifnei Hashem. But we used this area on the eastern side, that Shar Nicanor, the eastern entrance to the Azara. Mitzoraim Nami. Mitzoraim, as we discussed the issue yesterday, Dechtiv, Emira Kuena Mitaher, and that they have to place the blood and the oil on the thumbs and big toes of the Mitzoraim, who cannot enter into the Azara, but they need to participate in this way with the Korban. So the threshold where we have that happen is at Shar Nicanor, because there the gateway itself was not Nitkadesh, as opposed to other gateways where the outer threshold set the level of Kedusha. Over here by Nicanor, it's the inner threshold that set the Kedusha, and therefore you could be right up against the Azara while standing in the area of Shar Nicanor in order to accommodate this issue of the Mitzorain, whether that's because Bia b'miksat lo shmei Bia, or whether there is no restriction on the Mitzorah to do this because that's part of his Tara process. But either way, he stands right at that threshold and sticks his feet and his hands into the Azara and put the oil on his head as well. All of those are done right there at the threshold of the Shar Nicanor. Elo yoledet my time. Why does a yoledet have to be there? Ilema mishum da atyon v'kaimin akurbanayhu. If you say it so that she will be present, standing by her korban, d'tanya in korbano shel adam karev elim keno made al gabav. A person's korban is only brought if they are present and they are proximate to the korban. Iachi zavin v'zavot nami. Then why are you picking on a yoledet? Why don't you pick anybody who has to bring a korban in this manner to be nitaher in order to go through the process of tahara? They should also be included in this list. So why did you just mention yoledet? Where it says enochanami, v'tanachada minayu nakat. That the Tana here just enumerated one of the many. Yoledet is representative of all those that are found in Parshat Tazria. Yoledet's in the beginning. At the end of Mitzorah, you have zav zava. So there, she is representative of that type of class of Tahara, and anybody who's in that class of Tahara also, where they can't enter in, they can't go into the Mikdash, nevertheless, they want to be as adjacent, proximate to their Korban as they can be. And so she comes to the Shar Mizrach to be there. It's interesting only because the woman is not necessary to be there. The Korbanot of a Yoledet do not necessitate her to be there whatsoever. The Mishnah and the Gemara discuss the fact that she used to buy the Ptakim to get her birds, hand them over to the individual who had the birds, bring them to the Kohen, and then the Kohen would do them alastam, because there were so many birds that were brought, wasn't clear who it belonged to, which woman it belonged to, and the woman might not have even been present. And the Gemara there says that she can be certain that the Kohanim are Zvizim him, and that the Korban was put on the Mizbeach, and that's why by nightfall she would already consider to be Tehora, because they are not Mitatzlim Badavar. Because Beit Din ensured that the Kohanim did this. So again, indications that the woman was not present when this was done. And the reason to be present is only in cases where you really need to do smicha, where one has to lean or put their hands on the animal, or do vidui. In those instances, you can understand this statement of Ein Kurbano Shel Adam Karev Elim Ken Omed Al Gabav, that demand makes sense in those situations. In this situation, when there's neither of those, then why does the woman have to be present? So what you'd have to suggest here is that this is a din derabanan of some sort, or this is considered to be something nice or proper to do, but it's not ma'akev the korban, because we have other evidence to the contrary that this isn't ma'akev the korban. So now, Tan Rabbanan, ein mashkin shtei sotot ka'achat. You're not allowed to have two sotot, or the process, procedures of two sotot, done at once. Kidei shelo yehe liba gas b'chaverta. Because we don't want one to draw strength from the other. For instance, if one is guilty and one is innocent, the one who's innocent is going to hold out. And her holding out will give strength to the other woman to hold out as well, even though she's really guilty. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, lo min hashem huzeh. That's not the problem over here. Problem does not have to do with the influence that one woman has over the other. El amar kra, ota levada. So gzerata katuv, that the sota has to be brought, ota, over here. Rashi quotes, vishbi'a ota kohen, whereas in the Darim, there it says, vishka ota, which would probably make more sense, because that's within the context of what we're discussing here, which is ein mashkin shtei sotot, but the word ota is used, and the Gemara dashes from that ota, levada, that she has to be alone. It's a gzerata katuv. Well, the Tanakhama also has the word Ota. Why does he bring a reason rather than focus on the Gzerata Katuv? Where it says, Tanakhama, Rabbi Shimon, he. The Tanakhama is Rabbi Shimon, the Darish Tam Tekro. Uma Tam Kamar, where he explains the reasoning behind the Gzerata Katuv. In Okanami, Ota is the source, but Rabbi Shimon goes ahead and explains the reason behind the mitzvah. Why is it that we say she has to be ota levada? Matam kamar, he comes to explain the reasoning behind it. Matam ota levada. Why is it that she has to be alone when we're mashkid sotot? Kedei lo shelo yehei liba gas b'chaverta. In order that she doesn't draw strength from the other sota that is there, it doesn't give her impetus to hold out or to insist on her innocence because of the other woman that is doing the similar thing. Both the Ramban and the Rambam explain that giving Tamei mitzvot is something that is encouraged and something that they both do. And it's not just solely Rabbi Shimon's opinion. We believe in trying to understand as much as we can that which the Torah demands. The difference between Rabbi Shimon and the way that we go about explaining the reasons behind the mitzvot is that Rabbi Shimon allows the Tam Tekra, allows the reasoning behind the Pasuk, to determine when the din is applicable or not applicable. I mean that there are nafka minot to the reason according to Rabbi Shimon. The classic case is by the case of the mashkon that is taken from the almana. So Rabbi Shimon over there says that's talking about a poor almana. Because by a poor almana, you're going to have to return the item every night and then take it back in the morning. You have to go in and out of her house. So over there, we don't allow you to, we don't want you to take the collateral from her. On the other hand, if she was a rich woman, where she didn't need the item back, you would be permitted to take a mashkon. So that's Rabbi Shimon's explanation for that restriction against taking a mashkon, a collateral from an almana. On the other hand, the Chachamim argue with Rabbi Shimon and say, that might be the reason, but there's no nafkamina. Almana is almana, and you can't take collateral from either of them. So when we give a reason to the Tamei mitzvot, which many Tanaim do, which many Amoraim do, and many Rishonim do, over there we are, I would call it speculating in a sense, as to the reason for the mitzvah, and we're trying to understand the mitzvah as best as we can, but in the bottom line is that even when the reason doesn't apply, the mitzvah still applies. According to Rabbi Shimon, When you give a reason for the mitzvah, that influences how we view the mitzvah going forward. And it'll have a lochit nafkaminot for this, and it'll be normative, the reason. And so by the case of the almanah, where we say that if it's a rich almanah, he can be memashkenota. And in our case over here, there'll be a nafkamina between Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda along those lines, which is my benayhu. What's the nafkamina? If they're both darshaning from the word otah, just Rabbi Shimon explains why that is. What is the difference between them? Miki benayhu ro tetet. A case where the woman is trembling, she's in trepidation, it is clear that she is not taking any solace in the fact that her friend is there, and we see that she's fearful of the mesota. So over there, there's no reason to worry about bringing them together because she clearly is not influenced by the resolve of the other woman. So now that's interesting because you really only solve the problem for one of the two women. Rotetet is one of the women, but there's still a second woman that's there, and that should present a problem for us. So there are those that change the girsa from rotetet to rotetot, that they are both fearful. Although others explain to support the girsa that we have, the girsa of Rashi, which is that once one of the women is breaking down, so that woman's clear that she's not taking any solace of the other woman being there, but she will also, just like when she has resolve in her innocence, she influences the other woman, so to over here, where she's in trepidation and trembling, she's also going to influence the other woman to be more fearful. And it actually have the opposite effect. And then it won't have this impact on the other woman to hold out. So therefore, even if just one of them is rotetet, maybe that would be sufficient grounds to allow them to be together. Now the Gemara asks a more fundamental question. Virotetet mimashkin. Wait a minute. Even if she is fearful, has trepidation about the water, would we give it to her if there are two sotot there together? The assumption being here that if you clear the issue of libo gas bechaberta, like Rabbi Shimon says, then you would be allowed to give two sotot to drink simultaneously. According to Rabbi Yehuda, it's a gzeret hakatuv, you're never going to have that. According to Rabbi Shimon, it's doresh time of the krah, so if you overcome the reason behind why we don't bring two sotot together, like in the case where she's rotetet, we would assume that you can give both sotot to drink simultaneously. Gemara says, is that allowed? Forgetting about the reason of libo gas bechaberta, there's a more fundamental problem over here, which is, vayinu sim mitzvot, chavilot, chavilot. You're not allowed to stack up mitzvot. You're not allowed to do mitzvot in an assembly line manner. That's none. It's really betanyo, emashkim shtei sotot kachat. You're not allowed to give two sotot to drink at once. Vei mitarim shnei mitzoraim kachat. You're not allowed to bring two mitzorim to be mitahir them simultaneously. You can't pierce the ears of two avadim, Eved Ivri, who wants to stay on to the Yovel. You can't process them simultaneously. Rashi over here says that's a case of Adon Echad and Beit Din Echad. It's where they have a similar master and it's in one Beit Din. Tosafot points out, it seems strange that you would demand both a similar owner and a similar Beit Din because, for instance, in the case of Mitzoraim, that's the equivalent case to two owners, but one Kohen that is processing them. So why one Beit Din should be sufficient grounds to say, Eino si mitzvot chavilot chavilot, and why do you have to have a single master? But Rashi requires both of those. Beinofim shteglot keachat, you don't do egla rufa, two of them simultaneously. Fi she'eino si mitzvot chavilot chavilot. We don't make mitzvot into piles. Rashi over here gives the reason behind that, which is, Shinireh kemisha yu'alav lemasui. Because it looks like it's a burden. Umemaher lefarek masa'o. And therefore he's trying to, in a most expeditious manner, discharge these obligations or get rid of these obligations. So when you do it in this manner, it looks like you're not trying to do the mitzvot. You're not doing a proper kavanah to engage in the mitzvot Hashem, but rather, you know, you have a list of things to do, and here, if I can knock these off together, it'd be great. Amar Abaye v'itei Rav Kahana lo kasha, that's not a problem. Kan b'kohen echad, kan b'shnei kohanim. Depends if it's one kohen or two kohanim. Rashi explains that over here is b'kohen echad, habi chavilot. That when you do it one kohen, that's deemed to be chavilot, because it looks like the one kohen is just trying to get everything done quickly. Give me these two sotot. I'm going to run through them. On the other hand, the shnei kohanim, that would be mutar, because then each one is engaging with one sota, and we don't consider it to be a person just trying to get rid of all the obligations that they have on them or the to-do list today, and they're trying to discharge it in the fastest manner possible. So that's the way that Rashi explains it. Tosafot explains it in a similar manner, although Tosafot notes that he thinks that this restriction of Enosim Mitzvot Chavilot is only a Takanat Chachamim. And he says that it's interesting that the Gemara brings it here, a Takanat Chachamim, to question a machloket in Psukim or a machloket d'oraita. Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda are arguing on the d'oraita level, and then you're questioning Rabbi Shimon's position from a din d'rabbanan. So Tosafot says it's a little surprising, but he does suggest that this Enosim Mitzvot Chavilot is a din d'rabbanan and not a din d'oraita. But in the end, he explains like Rashi that Kohen Echad is Asur, Shnei Kohanim are Mutarim. Now, you could read this Gemara the other way around. It's not clear here which one is the okay and which one is the not okay. I mean, is it Kohen Echad is the problem and Shnei Kohanim is okay? Or is it the other way around? That Kohen Echad is fine, Shnei Kohanim is problematic. So you can see here that the Rabbi Kiva Eger references you to a Magen Avram in Hilchot Kriyat HaTorah. And over there, the Magen Avram discusses this issue, and he makes a suggestion that the Rambam actually believes just the opposite of what Rashi and the Tosafot say, because the Rambam doesn't bring down this distinction of Kohen Echad and Shnei Kohanim, and therefore he believes that the Rambam thinks just the opposite way around, that if it's one Kohen, it's fine. With Shnei Kohanim, it is problematic. And there he lists a nafka mina between these two shitot, based on his assumption that the Rambam disagrees with Rashi and Tosfot over here, is in a case where you have two babies to get a Brit Milah, or twins to get a Brit Milah. Can you do the twins simultaneously, or do you have to do them one after the next? So according to the Bali at Tosfot and Rashi, the only problem here is if you have one mohel that's doing them. So if you have one mohel that's doing them, then you can't do it one after the next, because that looks like Enosim Mitzvot Chavilot Chavilot. Therefore, you would have to get a different mohel, but two mohalim would be fine. You could do them simultaneously as long as there were two separate mohalim. If there aren't two separate mohalim, then you're going to have to take a break in between. Whereas according to the Rambam in this case, you would be able to do it b'kohen echad, meaning that a mohel could do them back to back, and it wouldn't be a problem. But you couldn't have two mohalim doing it simultaneously, because that looks like osim mitzvot chavilot chavilot. We are choshesh for both shitot in this case, and therefore, when we have a brit milah of twins or multiple babies, not only do we not do them simultaneously with two different mohalim, but even with one mohel, we don't do it one after the next. And even with one mohel after one of the next, we wait in between and we give a break. So we avoid the problem of the Rambam Shita as well as the Shita of the Tosafot according to the Magen Avraham. But the Magen Avraham brings up this issue with regards to Brit Milah, and over there he brings it up with regards to taking out the Sifrei Torah, reading from multiple Sifrei Torah as to the relationship here to Enosim Mitzvot Chavilot, Chavilot. But he sees that distinction between them. There is a Tosafot in Moed Katan on Daf Chet where the Gemara discusses Ein Ma'arvim Simcha B'Simcha. Over there, Tosafot, well, seems to equate it in some way to Enosim Mitzvot Chavilot, Chavilot. And there he says the reason that Ein Ma'arvim Simcha B'Simcha is because Ein Libo Panui L'Simcha. His heart is not open to the celebration that's there. If you have competing smachot, then the person's kavanah or ability to focus is diminished by the fact that he has to focus or concentrate on two different smachot. And therefore we say, Ein Marim Simcha Simcha, so that he can give his full attention to each simcha. And that could be the reason over here as well. As opposed to the way that Rashi's explained it, is because Nireya Alav Ke Masui, that it looks like it's a burden to you when you do it. It may be a more practical reason, which is that an individual faced with multiple mitzvot or dealing with multiple individuals can't give their full attention to each item. And since they can't give their full attention to each item, therefore there is an issue with doing mitzvot chavilot. Now, in our case over here, when you have two kohanim doing it, that would seem to be okay because each one could focus on their mitzvah. If you have one kohen doing it, one after the next, then also each one seems to get its own individual attention. What you would have to say is the fact that he's worried about the other one or that he's processing them both at the same time, even though in the end he does it sequentially, his focus or the knowing in his mind that he has both of them to take care of, that will diminish his ability to focus completely or to deal with each mitzvah appropriately. And so because of that, we demand that there be a separation, whether that's a separation in gavra, and two different people process it, or a separation in time, so that the individual can focus on each one appropriately and not doing them simultaneously. The achronim over here discuss when do we apply inosim mitzvot chavilot versus when do we not apply it. We find in many mitzvot that we accomplish multiple items with a mitzvah. So where is it properly applied or not properly applied? The Or Sameach suggests that it's a question of whether you have to be present to do the mitzvah or you can send a shliach. In a mitzvah where you can send a shliach, then we don't worry about inosim mitzvot chavilot. Since you could designate someone to accomplish a mitzvah on your behalf, so too, if you do it multiple of those mitzvot simultaneously, it won't be problem of enosim mitzvot chavilot, because you could have easily or just as well handed over to many shlichim and have it happen simultaneously. So there we don't see as being a detriment to the accomplishment of the mitzvah. On the other hand, where you personally have to accomplish the mitzvah, there we say that enosim mitzvot chavilot might be, or enhanced by that reason of the Tosafot of Moed Katan, which is not only does it look like a masui, but you're going to be unable to focus on the mitzvah at hand if we allow you to do multiple mitzvot at once. Other achronim describe the difference between whether there's a maaseh that has to be done for each individual mitzvah, or single maaseh can accomplish all of those mitzvot. If through one action you can accomplish all those mitzvot, we don't invoke enosim mitzvot chavilot. Whereas if you need a separate action for each mitzvah, then we're going to say that that's enosim mitzvot chavilot, because there, each independent action may start to make it look either like a masoi or the lack of focus in those issues. All right. V'kohen ochez bibigadah. So here it's kohen grabs under her clothing, we said, when she was up there. Tosfot notes that based on the Tosefta, they had a lottery to see which kohen would have to do this. Doesn't seem like it was the choicest of jobs to get as a kohen. And therefore they threw a lot to see who got it. And in that lot was even included the kohen gadol. So it's possible that the kohen gadol would be chosen. But whoever it lands on, they are chosen to do this, to grab onto her beged. Tan Rabbanan, uparat rosh ha'isha, that you are poreya, the head of the woman. The word upara, and leads to some of the controversies surrounding this, can be used in two contexts. Upara can be to strip off, to uncover. Or the word para could be used to untie or release. And so therefore over here, the Gemara is trying to figure out, not trying to figure out, but the Gemara is using it in both ways, which is, uparat rosh ha'isha, you reveal the head of the woman. Ainli ela rosha, that's only her head. Gufa minayin, how do I know that you also expose her body? Tamalomer ha'isha, it's as if it's written, upara et ha'isha, that you expose the woman herself. So then, if from this pasuk you're going to learn that you expose the woman in general, then you don't need a specific about the hair. Because if you're going to expose her, that includes her hair. So then, what are you going to make of upara et rosha? If you're separating or parsing the pasuk as reading upara et rosha and upara et aisha, then upara subsumed under upara et aisha is upara et rosha. So then Parat Rosha must teach you something. Malaid, Shakwain Soteret Sarah. That teaches you that the queen not only uncovers her hair, but also unbraids or undoes the braiding of her hair. And therefore we're going to use the word upara here in its second meaning, which is not only to uncover or to reveal, but rather also to undo, untie. And that will refer to the undoing of the braids of the woman. So Rashi over here says the definition of para in all cases, b'chol makom lashon gilui hu. In most cases where the word of para is used, it's used as an exposure of sorts. So now, the way Rashi explains soter et sara then, upara et rusha is mirabe b'giluya, soter kliata. You make the exposure even greater. So Rashi says the word para only has one definition, and that is exposure. So that exposure can be increased or enhanced by untying her braid. Uncovering her hair is already one form of exposure. You want to make her even more exposed, then you undo her braids. Whereas others see the word upara, not necessarily to be an exposure, but to have both definitions. The definition of exposure or to uncover, as well as the meaning of to untie or to release. And therefore, the Gemara is darshaning the word or the verb being used in both meanings. So, from this, again, as we mentioned yesterday, derives much of the machloket about what exactly midoraita a woman has to cover of her hair. And then, if she doesn't have to cover all of her hair midoraita, what does she have to do with the remaining hair? And the question of how the braids play or interplay with the covering of her hair over here. Are the braids to deal with the hair that's outside of the hair covering? Are the braids just simply a practical mechanism for allowing her to cover her hair because it keeps it compact and therefore it's easier to cover the hair? And the undoing of the braids are just more exposure because women don't usually uncover those? Or is that something that where outside in the public domain she would have her hair covered, but inside of her house or in areas that were less exposed, maybe she has to have her hair partially covered or braided versus totally covered? All of these interplays come up with this Gemara and the Gemara that we learned in Tubot to have the Rishonim and the Achronim Poskim formulate what exactly is the necessity in terms of covering one's hair, midoraita, what is the dat Yehudit that adds on top of that, and what are the things that are only subject to minhag makom, and where is that true? Is that only true in the public domain? It's not true in the house? Or is it true everywhere? We have opinions from mikzeh al kzeh, from one side to the next, which has the chasam sofer on one side, which says that the woman must cover every piece of hair on her head, whether she's out in the public domain or in her own home. She has to cover every hair, and she can't have anything exposed. To Otzrot HaMefarshim, who say that it's kol talui b'minhag ha-makom, and that the minhag ha-makom would determine how much of the hair the woman has to cover, or maybe even whether she has to cover her hair at all, because the question of the erva here is that it is a subjective erva rather than an objective erva, and therefore the makom, or what's the norm of society, would be heavily influential on determining what the erva, or the necessity to cover one's hair, is over here, at least with regards to the dat Yehudit, but maybe even more than that. So you have opinions that go from, again, from the either extreme, and then many of the other poskim and rishonim land in the middle somewhere, as to the extent and to the location where a woman must cover her hair. There is the famous Aruch HaShulchan, who is misquoted many times, who says that with regards to the woman's hair, it's not considered to be an erva. And that's how most people misquote the Aruch HaShulchan, saying that the Aruch HaShulchan says that today you don't have to cover your hair because the norm in society is not to cover one's hair, and therefore it's no longer an erva. That's not what the Aruch HaShulchan says. The Aruch HaShulchan says that with regards to Kriyat Shema, where one is not allowed to read Kriyat Shema Keneged HaErva, so hair is an erva, and if a woman's hair is uncovered, one cannot read Kriyat Shema Keneged that hair, even if it's his wife's hair, because it's deemed to be an erva. To that, the Aruch HaShulchan says to be melamed zchut on people, or to deal with the situation today where women don't cover their hair, says that maybe today, because the norm in society is not to cover one's hair, therefore it won't be deemed erva for Kriyat Shema. And that might have to do with the way that we view erva in general. When we talk about erva, the exposure of the body, where you can't read Kriyat Shema Keneged Erva, it's true for a man and a woman, in terms of the exposure of the body. If there's a man who's undressed, you can't say Kriyat Shema as well. But in certain instances, when we talk about Erva, Erva is objective in nature, because whether we get it from the psukim or whether it's obvious to everyone that those are considered to be erva or rayot, or inappropriate areas to expose. And so those are considered to be objective arayot. Whereas hair may not be an objective erva. It may not be obvious that the hair is an erva, except for the fact that the Torah calls it an erva. So there may be an obligation to cover one's hair because the Torah says to cover the hair. And because the Torah says to cover the hair, that makes it into an erva. And so based on that, the Aruch HaShulchan might be seeing a room to give this kula by Kriyat Shema. He's not saying that a woman doesn't have to cover hair. He says unequivocally that the woman has to cover her hair and that it's wrong that they're not covering their hair. But if they don't cover their hair, and that is the norm in society, maybe we can no longer deem it to be an erva. There's still a requirement to cover the hair, but maybe it doesn't have that status of erva vis-a-vis Kriyat Shema. Anyway, that's the famous Aruch HaShulchan in dealing with the modern phenomenon or problem of women not covering their hair and how that affects the ability to daven in a shul when there are women who have their hair uncovered and in situations or places where it's more and more common for that to be the case. What do you do about davening? What do you do about Kriyat Shema? So he's melamed zchut about how maybe we can get around it, but in no way suggests that women don't have to cover their hair. All right, the Gemara says, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, imaya liba na'eh, if her heart was beautiful, or he says about by her hair, or by her body, that the exposure here would be counterproductive because she's pretty, and therefore undressing here would be problematic. The Memra, the Rabbi Yehuda, chayish lirhura. Rabbi Yehuda worries about hirhur, about the fact that this might cause the men there to get excited by the fact that you're exposing the woman. So if she's beautiful, that would be something that has that impact. Rabbanon lo chayishli. And since from the Mishnah, the Rabbanon don't worry about that because they don't even consider this problem. Now, the truth is that you should worry about it even without hirhur, based on the reason that I spoke about, which is that if the woman is beautiful, exposing her will give her more resolve to hold out, because this in exposing her or undressing her, instead of being minavelota, instead of denigrating her, it's actually making her feel better because she's able to now show off her beauty and to expose herself in this manner, and that would actually give her more strength to hold out. The Baalei HaTosafot over here say that the question really revolves around the fact that there is a gzeirat hakatuv, that you have to expose the woman, ufarat rosh ha'isha, which we just learned meant expose her body and her hair. So then how come the Gemara is even questioning, or why does Rabbi Yehuda even have any consideration over here? So Tosfot invokes the principle that we know many places in Shas, which is sheva al tase. In the cases where you're passive, we allow you to violate or to skip a mitzvah asay. And so that's what we're doing over here. There is a mitzvah to be parat rosh ha'isha, and that means her and her body. Nevertheless, b'shev da'al tase, in cases of passivity, will allow you to violate that if there's sufficient reason for that. So what is sufficient reason? So what we're suggesting now is the fact that it will be strengthened her resolve would not have been enough of a reason to not accomplish this gzeret hakatuv or this mitzvah. But if you have that together with the problem of hirhur, that already might be, in totality, a great enough reason to say, let's not do this, because of the risks that are involved. And therefore, we're sheva tase. And that's why the Gemara focuses here on hirhur, and not on this libo gaspa, because you need more than just simply libo gaspa to override the gzeret hakatuv. So the Gemara says, from this you would conclude from our Mishnah, that Rabbi Yehuda is chayish lihirhura, Rabbanan lo chayishi, vayib chashim anyin lo. Didn't we hear just the opposite in their opinions? Titania. Aish mechasin oto perek echad milefanav, v'aisha shnei prakim, echad milefanav, v'echad milachorea, minei shekula erva divrei Rabbi Yehuda. In the case of capital punishment, where they're going to do skila as the punishment, if it's a man, we give him a loincloth to cover over his erva. And then if it's a woman, we give her two loincloths, one to cover over the front and one to cover over the back, shekula ervahi, because her exposure is from either side, or you can explain it more generically, kula ervahi, the woman being uncovered in general, she's kula erva, is a problem of erva. So that's Rabbi Yehuda's position. Chachamim amrim, aish niskalarum, The man is stoned naked, whereas the woman is not stoned naked. So over here it seems that the Chachamim worry about Hirhur, and therefore we don't allow the woman to be stoned naked, whereas Rabbi Yehuda seemingly does not worry about Hirhur and allows the woman to be stoned naked. So how come over here Rabbi Yehuda has no problem with the woman being exposed, whereas by the case of Sota, we do have a problem with the woman being exposed? Amarabba, hocha taima mai. What's the reasoning over here by the case of Sota? Shema teitze bibeitin zakait. Because maybe she will be proven innocent in this case. Vidgaru ba pirchei kuna. And the young kohanim that were there, that were present, will then have hirhurim, will be chased by this yetzahara about this woman who was exposed in front of them. Hatam ha mistauko is one possible girsa, or the other possible girsa is misatakla, mekatlo is the other girsa over here, which is that here she's being removed or she's being killed. By the case of the capital punishment, the woman is going to be quote unquote eliminated. She's not going to be around anymore afterwards. Whereas in the case of Sota, there's a possibility that she will be proven innocent and she will be walking the streets again and be around afterwards. So maybe you're going to think that there is this ability to have transference of yetzer hara or desire from one woman to the next. So they see this woman is being stoned and therefore it's going to cause them to have those feelings, those desires about another woman. Hamarova. We have a misora from Rova, Gmire. So Gmire usually means that we have a misora to this manner, or maybe they empirically understood this or tested it out. That the Yetzara only plays on a person when something that they see. So not necessarily that they have to physically see it, but the fact that it's around makes it possible. So here in the case of a woman who is being killed, once that woman is eliminated from the scene, even though, quote unquote, there could have been hirhurim, there could have been exposure here to the individual, that will not carry on because the woman is no longer around. So first of all, we don't assume that that desire or that hirhur will transfer to another woman. That's number one. Number two is we don't assume that they will continue to have hirhurim about this woman because there's no plausible reality to that. Even though as far-fetched as the reality could be, there is no possible reality like that because the woman is no longer around. By the case of Sota, the problem is that the woman's going to be walking around after that. And therefore, these hirurim could persist because anytime they see this woman, anytime they think about this woman, because the possibility exists that she's alive, and therefore, even as far-fetched, there's a possible reality to this hirur that will continue or that will burn the desire inside of them. That's how we differentiate between the case here where Rabbi Yehuda says don't expose her versus the case by the capital punishment. He says it's no problem to expose her. Tosvot over here asks, Tema. He says, I don't understand. Kaven delov choval anashim lirota. Since there's no obligation for the men to see her exposed like this, yitlu sadin shel bilts beinah lebein anashim. Why don't they put up a mechitza between her and the men? Vistor Sarah, and then they will uncover her hair. Even the Kohen can turn his back, undo her hair, grab her beged, or give her exposure while she's behind the mechitza. Therefore, there's going to be no problem of hirhurim. Why are we worried about hirhurim here? Just put up a mechitza, and because the men are not obligated to be there or to have to see her. Tosfot says something along the lines of what you're suggesting over here. He says that Vishlomar the Rabbi Yehuda, imayu porsim sadim beinah lebein anashim lo yeh nivul kol kach bifnei anashim. If you limit her exposure to in front of the women, that would not be considered a denigration enough that would cause her to either want to admit to her sin or be a preventative measure for women in the future, because she's only being exposed in front of other women. If you bring it into a picture that she's exposed in front of men, women, everyone, that type of exposure, that type of nivul is much more impactful. And therefore, putting up a mechitza would actually defeat part of the purpose over here of being menavel, the isha, because she would no longer feel so embarrassed because now she has some sort of screen there. She has some sort of protection to the exposure. And therefore, even though it would have been a good solution, it's problematic because then it takes away from the effectiveness of undressing her or uncovering her hair, which is this idea of nivul. When there's no exposure, there is no nivul. All right, so now the Gemara says, Amar Rava, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yehuda, Kasha, Rabbanon, Rabbanon, Lo Kasha. All right, Rabba, you solved the problem, the stira between the two shita of the Rabbi Yehuda, but what about the Rabbanon? The Rabbanon have the same problem. Over here by Sota, they don't worry about it, and there by the case of capital punishment, they do worry about it. Ela Amar Rava, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yehuda, Lo Kasha. The stira in Rabbi Yehuda is not a question, Kiddushanin. That we learned already. We already gave an answer to explain why he has a differentiated opinion here in Sota versus that of capital punishment. The Rabbanon and the Rabbanon, Nami Lo Kasha. I can also explain the difference in the Rabbanon's position. Hacha Taimamai. What's the reason over here? By Sota Mishum Vinish Vasru Kol Anashim. The pasuk that was quoted at the end of the Mishnah. That the women will take a lekach. That this will be a lesson or a deterrent for other women. And therefore, the more the exposure, the more the humiliation of this woman, the better it serves that purpose of inivasru kol anashim, that they should not act in this manner, or they should not bring themselves to a chashad, v'tiyena tsnuot. Because remember, this woman has raglaim ledavar. It's not simply that her husband suspected her. There's a lot more going on here. And this should be a preventative measure for these women. Hatam in the chayisur gadol mizeh. By the case of capital punishment, death is the ultimate deterrent. You don't need her to be exposed or naked there in order to make it any more of a deterrent. Gemara says, "V'chidei malavid batarte." Well, just make the deterrent greater. Not only will you get stoned, but you also get stoned naked. So that would make it even more of a deterrent. Why not do more if you're trying to accomplish that value of deterrence? So Rav Nachman Amar Rabba Bavur Amakra V'hafta L'reacha Kamocha. We have a requirement of Ahavta L'reacha Kamocha. Bror lo mita yafa. You should pick a proper mita, which is the most painless and easiest mita for the individual. Using this principle, the Gemara says the death penalty that's carried out, assuming that we accomplish what the Torah set out to designate for us, then we're going to do it in the least painful manner, or the manner that causes the least humiliation, because of the principle of Ahavta L'reacha Kamocha. That if Chas V'Shalom you were in the same position, what would you want for yourself? And therefore we will do that for this individual. It's an amazing Musar Haskel here, because we're talking about someone who is on death row, someone who deserves to die, has done something grave, and therefore is going to be put to death. Nevertheless, the principle of Ahavta L'reacha Kamocha still applies. It tells you how important Ben Adam L'Chaveiro is. That even here, someone who is completely abrogated Ben Adam L'Makom, and therefore is going to be put to death, nevertheless, you still have a requirement of Ahavta L'reacha Kamocha. It tells you how paramount the mitzvah of Ahavta L'reacha Kamocha is, and Ben Adam L'Chaveiro is. So Gemara says, Lema D'Rav Nachman T'Naehi. Let us say that Rav Nachman's principle is a machloket tanaim. Meaning here, the machloket between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim will revolve around Rav Nachman's principle. Do we say that Vavta L'Reacha Kamocha governs over here, and that's the Rabbanan's position, therefore she remains fully dressed? Or do we say his principle does not apply, and therefore you strip her down except for the loincloth? That is Rabbi Yehuda's position. And maybe they're arguing in Rav Nachman's position. So lo, the Kuliyama Itlu the Rav Nachman. No, both Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbanan agree that Rav Nachman's principle is put in place here. V'hachavaka miflege. The machloket is, what is the better v'hafta l'reacha kamocha over here? Mar sever bizyonei adifle tvei mitzara. That a person's humiliation is something that they're willing to undertake more than the pain that they would have to undergo de gufei. Tzarei de gufei. Mar sever tzarei de gufei adifle tvei mi bizyonei. And others still say that physical pain is still better than the humiliation that is associated with it. So the Ahavta L'reacha Kamocha, we want to give the most painless death given the circumstances. So over here, if we strip them down, the likelihood that they will die quicker because there's nothing to cushion the impact will be enhanced. And therefore it's Ahavta L'reacha Kamocha because you reduce the pain that is involved. On the other hand, you then increase the humiliation because this is being done to them when they are stripped down. So the question is, what do we emphasize more? Do we emphasize the physical pain or do we emphasize the humiliation? And that's the machlok between Rabbanan and Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda believes that the pain, the physical pain, is the paramount importance over here. And a person is willing to undergo humiliation in order to accelerate the death so that they have less pain. On the other hand, the Chachamim believe that humiliation is the greater fact over here. And a person is willing to take a little more physical pain in order not to undergo that humiliation. Obviously, this is an important factor because Tosafot in Baba Kama already mentions the fact that Busha or Bizyona has a sense of nezek or detriment to the individual that is as bad as physical pain. And here you see the Gemara, in a sense, equating the two and saying that there is a trade-off between physical pain and humiliation, but it puts humiliation on the same strata as physical pain. And with the Balya Tosafot talking about busha, embarrassment or humiliation, but even more so in the modern day post-scheme, where the psychological impact of items is just as important as the physical aspect of items. So that a person can be sick physically or injured physically, but they can also be injured psychologically or through humiliation. And therefore the psychological damage that is done also has to be taken into consideration in certain circumstances or in passing halacha where we're willing to be makil or not be makil. And it's not all about physical pain, but there's also this psychological aspect. And here the Gemara clearly equates them. It's very interesting that the punishment that was used in general in earlier times was public humiliation. So for instance, if a woman engaged in adultery, then she would be brought out to the public square and she would be made to stand there and face the humiliation in public for what she did. In America, it happened as well. But the reason that it was stopped is because the impact, the psychological impact of that humiliation made it that a person was, in most cases, unable to recover from that psychological damage from the humiliation. And that the public humiliation of an individual has so much impact on the individual that that punishment is probably greater than the crime itself, or the effectiveness of the humiliation is so great that it does so much damage that you can't recover from that humiliation. And that's why in many places, taking into consider the human element, they stop doing these types of public punishments or exposures of people's sins because of the fact that there's more to just the deterrence that is created through this. But it damages the individual and maybe even in cases like that, their family, their kids, to the point where they may not be able to recover from it and you leave them permanently damaged. In a case where you're just trying to punish or you're just trying to create a deterrence, it does much more damage than that. And so here the Gemara itself is aware of the fact that humiliation is a serious issue when it comes to individuals. Gemara says, "Hayta mechusa livanim." If she was wearing white, then we have her put on black. We switch the clothing to make it that she is not in a mode that is presentable or pretty. Tana, imayush chorim na'im la. Well, here we're saying she's changing out white to black. But if this woman looks good in black, mechasinotah b'gadim mechuarim, then we pick clothing that is not pretty, not flattering to the woman, and they put it on. I don't know if they had an advisor or some sort of consultant that helped them with these issues as to what is not going to make this woman look beautiful, or whether this is a beautiful woman, to get all this information down. Ayu alei klei zav, if she has jewelry on her, then we take the jewelry off, the adornments off. Pshita, I mean, what are you thinking? Hashte navlei minavyala. Over here, you are humiliating her, denigrating her by uncovering her hair, ripping her clothing. You think, hani mi boy? You hear, you think you're going to leave her jewelry on? You're going to leave all of her adornments on? What's even the havamina that you would leave them on? Where it says, Maudutema, Bahani Itla Bizayon Tfe. No, that might be even more humiliating to leave the jewelry on. Kedam She Insheg, because we have this common saying, which is Shliach Artil Bisayim Misane. You have a naked messenger who ties his shoes or wears his shoes. That it's more laughable to look at someone who is naked wearing shoes than it is to look at someone who's naked not wearing shoes. So the addition of shoes makes it that it's even more humiliating to a person who's naked. So the same thing over here. Maybe the exposure, leaving the jewelry on, would make it actually more humiliating because you've removed all the other items and left the jewelry on, and maybe that would give it. Kamash Milan, that we don't say that, and we take all the jewelry or the adornments off. So then afterwards you bring this type of rope. As Rashi explained before, that Chevel HaMitzri is Mitzurei Adekel, is from the bark of the bark of the palm tree. The Tosafot over here quotes the Yushalmi that says Chevel HaMitzri is literally Mitzri from Mitzrayim, because she did Maseh Mitzrayim. As the Parshiot in Vayikra dealing with Arayot say, don't do Kemaseh Mitzrayim. That Arayot and that type of promiscuous behavior was associated with Canaan and Mitzrayim. So here we're telling her, you did Maseh Mitzrayim, therefore we're going to put a Chevel HaMitzri around you. And therefore they look at Mitzri being literally Mitzrayim, whether that was because the rope came from Mitzrayim or was commonly used in Mitzrayim, or it's simply just a play on the words. It really is Tzurei Adekel, but Mitzri or Mitzrayim has almost a double entendre here, which is not only is it referring to the bark of the palm tree, but also to Mitzrayim. Barmine Rabbi Ava mi Rav Huna, Chevel HaMitzri, Ma'u Shiyakev Besulta. Is the placement of that rope around the woman to hold up her clothing, is that Ma'akev Besulta? Tosafot over here jumps on this and says, what do you mean? Uparat Rosh HaIsha, we saw before, is not Ma'akev, according to Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says, there, if she's a pretty woman, we don't undo it. There where you have the Gzera Taktuf, it's explicit in the Pasuk that you have to uncover her hair, we still say it's not Ma'akev. Here, with something that's not explicit in the Pasuk, you're going to say it's Ma'akev, the Sota. What is the question here at all? It's obvious that it's not Ma'akev. Things that are written aren't Ma'akev because it's not duplicated in the Pasuk, or it doesn't have one of those words that makes it that it is Ma'akev, and therefore it's not Ma'akev. So what's the Gemara's question? So Tosafot rephrases the Gemara's question as to what is the primary reason for Chevel HaMitzri? Because once you determine the primary reason, then we will make decisions based on that primary reason, which is Bishom Shlo Yishmetu Bigadeha Me'alehahu Ubetziltzul Katan Namisagi. Is the whole point of the rope to hold up her clothing, act like suspenders or a belt, and therefore if you have a thin belt or thin rope that you can put around her, that would suffice. Odilma Mishum Damamar Hi Chagra Lo Betziltzul. She dressed up and put on a nice belt around her for her lover. So therefore, the Kohen brings this type of rope, which is ugly, and again, maybe has the hint of Mitzrayim inside of it, and puts it around her, and therefore it would be Me'akev. Again, not Me'akev. So what Tosafot says over here, we're trying to determine what the primary reason is. Is the primary reason over here for the fact that to keep her clothing up? True, Chevel HaMitzri has these messages embedded in it, but the primary reason is to keep her clothing up. If that's the case, then we're not going to wait around. If we don't have a Chevel HaMitzri, we'll just tie something else to keep her clothing up. On the other hand, if the primary reason for Chevel HaMitzri is for the message embedded in it, not to keep her clothing on, then if we have another item and we can wait and get a Chevel HaMitzri, we're going to wait for the Chevel HaMitzri. Now that it's Ma'akev, but we would make extra efforts, or expend extra efforts, or wait a little bit to get the Chevel HaMitzri, because that is the primary reason why you need to put this belt on, not to hold her clothing up. So that's the way Tosafot rewords the question, or rephrases the question, to focus on the primary purpose, and then based on the primary purpose, we'd make a decision as to whether it's worth waiting, is it worth expending money to do this, or is it a matter of convenience? And therefore, if we have something else, and we don't have it here, we're just going to go on with something else. So I'm related to Nitua. We have it in our Mishnah. You bring the Chevel HaMitzri and you tie it up. So that her clothes don't fall down. I mean, that the Mishnah itself explicitly states the reason as that it should be holding up her clothing or suspending her clothing. And that becomes the primary reason for this. Even though there's an embedded message here, the primary reason is still simply to hold up her clothing. Anybody who wants to come and see this spectacle can come and see it. So now the Mishnah has an internal steerer, which we mentioned, which is Hagufakasha. Amart, anybody who wants to come and see her, see this spectacle can come. Alma loshna gabre loshna nishay. Doesn't matter whether they're men or women. Permission is given to everyone to come. I mean, that enhances the humiliation and also helps us with the deterrence factor, the more people that are present and that are there. But then at the end of the Mishnah, it says all the women are permitted to see her. Nashimin, anashim lo. Women, yes, men, no. How do you resolve that internal stira within our Mishnah? The first phrase seems to indicate that anyone can come. The second phrase seems to say that women who want to can come, but implying that men should not come. Amar Abaye, Targama, anashim. Say that the whole Mishnah is talking about women. That the first part, when it says anybody who wants to come and see, can come and see, that is modified or qualified by the latter statement, which is all the women are permitted to come and see her. The reason to write it there is because it's all the women, as opposed to Eved Vishivcha, which is what the Mishnah is doing in the end. But the first phrase where it says anyone who could come is really just referring to women. That's not what the Mishnah says. The Mishnah says anybody who wants to see her can come. It doesn't say women, it says anyone. The first phrase in the Mishnah is true, that anybody who wants to come and see her can come and see her. Men, women, makes no difference. But the women are obligated to come and see her. Shnemar, v'nevasru kol anashim v'lo tasena k'zimatchena. That women will take a lesson from this, and this will be a deterrent factor for women to act in this manner. And therefore, there's an obligation on the women to be there, and that's why the Mishnah repeats it. The first case is talking about the option to be there, that it's open to anyone who wants to come and see it. Whereas, in the latter part of the Mishnah, it says the women must be there, where the women can come, doesn't mean can come, it means they must go there. Why did it use the lashon of mutarot? So it uses lashon mutarot as opposed to the evident shifcha, who are asurot. So that's in contrast to the asurot, it says mutarot. But not that that means that it's optional, but rather it's obligatory. And still others say that Rava reads the Mishnah not as mutarot, but motrot, to be warned that the women have to be there, not that they are mutarot, but motrot, in order that they be warned or that they take a lesson from this. And therefore they reread the word from mutarot to motrot. Right now, we continue with the next Mishnah. The next Mishnah describes to us the continuing procedure of the Sotah, but gives us a general principle about what's happening here to describe the process. And that is, B'midash Adam Moded Ba Modedim Lo. And the way that a person acts, that's the way that Hashem acts towards them, or what is otherwise known in the common parlance as Midah Keneged Midah. That a person's behavior will be reflected in the way that Hashem acts towards this individual. And that's both the tova and the ra. That's for good and bad. If a person is forgiving, or a person is kind and generous, then Hashem will act the same way towards that individual, and Hashem will have the same midot towards that individual. If a person is coarse, and a person lacks emotion and kindness toward others, Hashem will act in the same way. And the same is true with regards to aveirot. If a person allows themselves the privilege of doing aveirot, then Hashem will expose them in the way that they acted in doing these aveirot. He kashta tatzma la'aveira. She made herself up, adorned herself in order to do this aveira, to seduce the man or to be together with her lover. Hamakom navla. So therefore, the Torah Hashem says that she will be humiliated and denigrated. He galta tatzma la'aveira. She exposed herself in order to perform this aveira, to be together with her lover. Hamakom gila aleha. And so therefore the Torah Hashem insists that now she is going to be exposed in front of everyone else. That's both the sin that she did, as well as her physically she's going to be exposed. Bierech hitchila baveira. Tchila, she began with her thigh to do the aveira. Vachakach habeten, and then afterwards the stomach. Fikach telakea yerech tchila, her thigh will be affected first, v'achakach habeten, and then her stomach. V'shar kol aguf lo palat. And don't worry, the rest of her body doesn't escape from the punishment. So the way that Rashi describes it over here, what does it mean? Biyerech tchila, biderech tashmish. That's the way that intercourse goes. Hayerech nehene tchila bekiruv basar. That the closeness of the flesh to each other gives the thigh pleasure at first. The fikach tilake yerech tchila. That's true by the klala. That has to do with the way the Kohen curses her, where he says, Actually, in reality, it actually happens the other way around, because she drinks it, ingests it, and therefore it affects her stomach first and then her thighs. But the way that the coin expresses the klala reflects the order here, which is yerech tchila, and then afterwards, then it's the beten, because she first got hana from the kiru basar by her thighs, and then afterwards, when the lover is on her, then her stomach, or when they have the intercourse, then she got that pleasure. That's the way Rashi describes it. Others describe that in the process of intercourse, the pisuk ragayim, the opening of the legs of the rachayim, happens first. And therefore, that's what it means, tchila, over here. But either way, the way that she perpetrated the aveira is now reflected in the way that she will be punished. And again, that's midah, keneged midah. I'm Rav Yosef. Afagav d'midah b'tela, b'midah lo batil. That even though the punishments of Beit Din have been eliminated, b'midah lo batil, nevertheless, the quid pro quo, which is assumed in those punishments, is still well and alive. So most interpret this to be referring to mitot Beit Din. There are Rishonim over here who explain that this is referencing back to the Mishnah over here, and saying that it's referencing back to our Mishnah to explain why that this din of sota is midah keneged midah. Dam Rabbi Yosef, v'chein tani Rabbi Chia, miyom shecharab Beit HaMikdash, from the moment that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, afupi shebatla Sanhedrei, abra mitot lo batlu. So even though the Sanhedrin no longer exists and there's no more capital punishment, nevertheless, the four mitot that were meted out by Beit Din still exist. Mar says, v'ha bitlu. What do you mean they still exist? They're not there anymore. We don't adjudicate cases with capital punishment and execute people. So they are gone. Ella din arba mitot lo batlu. The type of punishment that is associated with the arba mitot Beit Din still exists. Mishnit chayev skila. Someone who's chayev skila. O nofel min agag. Falls off from a high place. O chayad dorasto. Or is torn up by an animal. Again, to reflect the nature of skila, the way that a person would be niskal. So as Rashi explains over here, that the lion will pin him to the ground and tear him apart. So getting pushed to the ground and falling to the ground is the equivalent of skila, because skila was done by first throwing the person off a high place and killing him and then stoning them. Mishin t'chayev sreifa, o nofel b'dleika, is caught in a fire, o nachash mekisho, or is bitten by a snake and the venom of the snake burns inside of them. Mishin t'chayev hariga, someone who was chayav chenek, onim salam al-chut, is then given over to the government, the Romans punished in that way by beheading and using a sword. O listin bayinalav, or he's caught up by marauders who kill him in this way. Mishnit chayav chanika, someone who was going to be punished by chenek. O tovea menar, drowns. O mate besarunki, or dies through asphyxiation, which is a sickness or a disease that's discussed in the Mishnayot in Yoma. So he'll die for something that's similar to it. So you have, even though the Arba Mitot Beit Din no longer exists, Hashem has ways to mete out these punishments that give a semblance to what would have happened had they been subject to the Arba Mitot Beit Din. Tosfot over here points out that, first of all, that this statement of Yosef is relevant not only after the Churban HaBayit, but even during the time that Beit HaMikdash exists, because we only punish individuals where we have Edim V'Hatra'ah, where you have all the procedural qualifications that allow us to put the person to death. But in many instances, we're not going to get there, and the individual will not be put to death. So these punishments would apply to someone where we don't have hatra'ah, we don't have edim, but that these punishments would mete it out even in the time that there was a Beit Din. Nevertheless, the Gemara or Rabbi Yosef only focused on Charab Beit HaMikdash, as Tosfot says, because it's milta de psiko. Over there, once the Korban happened, that's true for everything, because there are no death penalties. If it was in the time of Beit HaMikdash, you have to differentiate between those that were chayav mitot, those that were not chayav mitot. So just to make it clean, he just said after the time of the Churban, everybody has this din, which is that if you're really chayav, one of the arba mitot Beit Din, that it is met out through different manners that resemble, that's what you said there. Tosafot over here talks about different instances where we see that the Gemara talks about punishments that come to people. For instance, where you have a person who killed b'mezid and we don't have witnesses, and you have a person who killed b'shogeg and we don't have witnesses. So the person who killed b'mezid is not going to be put to death, and the person who killed b'shogeg is not going to go to galut. So what does Hashem do? Hashem brings them together, and the individual is supposed to go to Galut, is climbing up a ladder. The one who is supposed to be put to death is under the ladder. And then the individual on the ladder falls on him, and now we have witnesses, so he'll go to Galut, and the other person was put to death. But Tosfot over here says that that doesn't necessarily match up to the punishments that they're deserving of. The person who kills is deserving of hereg. And yet he's being killed with something akin to skila, where something's falling him in. So Tosfot says, Yesh lamar delav davka nakat nofel min agag o chayad dorasto, el me'ein mita shenitchayev vayehareg. That's something that gives some sort of connection between the mita and this. Teretz, da'afal gav delav bar skila hu, even though he's not a bar skila, mihu. Mida me'mida hi. It's still a mida k'neged mida. Tozarek al chavero derech yiridahu. Generally, when you kill someone, you throw something, it's done in a downward motion. So too, vayipololav ve'yamot. So they're here too. When he falls down on him and kills him, it simulates the type of death that he created for someone else. So you have to find some connection between that, what happened, and what the message has been given. And that's why it's always dangerous to speculate about why something happens, or why someone is punished, or why some bad things happen, and try to connect it back to a specific aveira. So you see over here in Tosafot, it has to have some semblance, or there's some connection, but it's not always obvious what the connection is. And therefore one could mistakenly assume that they know why it happened, or what the reason is. And therefore one has to be very careful not to assign or assume that the punishment connects to a very specific aveira, or this is why this person is being punished, mida k'neged mida, because it's, as you see here, not as clean cut or clear as you would have assumed. And the Tosfot Shanz deals with it a different way. He says, in the case of the ladder and the guy walking under it, he was climbing the ladder with a sword or with a knife, and when he falls off, that's what kills the individual below, and that's how it becomes mita k'neged mida. So the Tosfot Shanz still requires a much stronger correlation between the death that is meted out and the connection to the arba mitot beitin. Whereas Tosfot here gives it a much broader perspective in saying that as long as there's some connection, or we can create some connection between them, that it exists. But again, it's not so simple to interpret or to know, and therefore you have to avoid trying to assign or explain certain types of punishments, or why things happen to people, or why events take place. Tanya, aya Rabbi Omer, minayin shebemidash adam oved ba modim lo. What is the source in the psukim for the fact that midah k'neged midah, that a person gets punished in the way that they violated the avera? Shneamar, b'sasa'a b'shelcha terivena. So b'sasa means like in a measured manner, or the way that Rashi interprets it, b'toch oto sa'a atzma. But that same measurement, b'shelcha terivena, that will be sent terivena, and that will be the thing that fights with them, or grabs them, or takes them on. So they will be fought with, or wrought with that exact measurement that they dished out. That's what will be given to them. Ein li ela sa'ah. Maybe that's only true when you're talking about big punishments, because a sa'ah is a large measurement. Maybe that's only true. Minayin l'rabot tarkav. How do I know that it applies even to something that is 3 kav, which is half a sa'ah? B'chatzi tarkav. 1.5 kav, which is a quarter of a sa'ah, or a kav, or a chatzi kav, or a rova kav, a quarter of a kav, v'chatzi rova, or an eighth of a kav, toman, which would be a 1/16 of a kav, v'uchla, which is 1/32 of a kav, minayin, how do I know even in those small averot that there's still a din of mida k'neged mida, minayin, tamal omar, ki kol sa'on so'ein barash. So there here means that every measurement makes that measurement makes its noise. So no matter what the aveira is, or the severity or type of aveira, there still will be a mida k'neged mida associated with it. Minayin shekol pruta b'tvurata mitzteref de cheshbon gadol. So how do you know that Hashem accumulates all the aveirot till you reach a critical mass by which then He punishes mida k'neged mida? Tamal omar achat de achat dimtso cheshbon. One by one, until we get to the proper measure. So that Hashem accumulates. So when they're too small, or too little to do the midah k'neged midah, we let it build up to the point then where there's a cumulative impact that is great enough or substantial enough in order to have the punishment be midah k'neged midah. And that's what we find by sota. Shemida shemadada ba madudula. The way that she acted, that is the way that we treat her. He amdal petach beita leira otlo. She stood on the entrance to her house in order to make herself available to him or for him to catch a glimpse of her. Lefika kohen otel kippah me'al rosha. Therefore, the kohen exposes her hair and takes the kippah off her head. Rashi says it's a tzaif. It's some sort of handkerchief or covering on her head. Others say kippah is a little like what we have today as a kippah. It's some sort of skull cap that was on top of the woman's hair. And he throws it beneath their feet. He kashtalo paneha. She put makeup on her face, adorned herself for him. Lefikach paneha morikot. Therefore, her face turns, call it yellowish green. She becomes sickly from drinking the me'amarim. Ki kachlalo einah. She put makeup on her eyes. Lefikach einah boltot. Therefore, her eyes bulge out of her head. Again, this is going to be described later on as to what the me'sota do to the woman if she is guilty. Ki kalalo et sara. She braided her hair for him. Lefikach kohen soter et sara. Therefore, the kohen undoes her hair, undoes the braids. So here you see both the uncovering of the hair, taking off the kippah, as well as the unbraiding of the hair. He heratalo be'etzba. She used her finger either to attract him, to seduce him or call him over, or in order to engage with this individual. The fikach tiporneh no shro. Therefore her nails fall off. He chagralo be'tziltzul. She girded herself or put her belt around herself for him. So she then brings this ugly rope and ties it above her chest in order to hold up her clothing. He pashtalo et yerecha. She extended her leg to him. Lefikach yerecha no felet. Therefore her thigh falls down, meaning that's what happens through the klala, through the mesota. He kibalto al kresa. She allowed him to lay on top of her to have bia with her. Lefikach bidnatzava. Therefore her stomach explodes. He echilato madne olam. She fed him delicacies. The fikach kurbana machal beima. Therefore, the kurbana sota, the mincha of the sota, is seorim. The only mincha seorim that is brought aside from the omer in the migdash, and that's reflected the fact that seorim are the machal beima, not chitim, because she fed him delicacies. Therefore, she's going to bring a kurban that is machal beima. He ishkato yain mishubach bekosot mishubachim. She fed him excellent wine inside of beautiful goblets. Lefika kohen mashke mayim amarim b'mekeda shel cheres. So she then is forced to drink the mayim hamarim, this terrible water, inside of a clay earthenware utensil. He asta b'seter. She did it in private. Yoshev b'seter oyon sampa panim. And therefore, the one who sits in the private, meaning God, turned his face towards her, and as Rashi explains over here, panim is always l'shon pone ani mikol asakai v'oskani behem. Because I'm going to turn my time or my attention to this individual and deal with them. So Hashem turned his face to them to expose this woman. Shenemar ve'ein no'eif shamra neshef lemor lo tushureni ayin. The eye of the one who is an adulterer does it in the still of the night, saying, Lo tishuveni ani, don't let anybody see me. Don't let anybody catch me in this act. And here, she did it in private, yet Hashem exposes that act to the public. Davar acher, he asta b'seter. She did it in private. Amakom pir mesama b'galoi. Over here, they exposed her in public. Shenamar, tikase sin'ah b'mashaon tigale ra'ato b'kal. The one who hides hatred in darkness, Tigale ra'ato, his evilness will be exposed in public. So it's over here where she perpetrates the act in private in darkness. In the end, she's now fully exposed to the public what she did. So again, midah k'neged midah, she did something in private. Therefore, the one who is really in private, God, comes to take retribution from her. And even more so, not only is it that he takes retribution, but she tried to hide it or do it in private, this act. And now she is fully exposed as to what she did. Okay, we'll stop over here, about a third of the way down on Tet Amud Aleph.